The economics of prisons never make sense. It's about sitting in the past rather than investing in the future.
Hello, and welcome to Marching On, the podcast brought to you by the ACLU of Kansas. I'm Micah Kubik, Executive Director at the ACLU of Kansas, and we thank you for joining us. We have two insightful conversations that we're excited to share on this episode of the podcast. First up, with the 2026 Kansas State Legislative Session behind us, mercifully behind us, we will hear from our Director of Policy and Research, Logan DeMond. Logan will give us a recap of what happened under the dome this year. The good, the bad, and the lots and lots and lots of ugly. Lawmakers have been particularly hostile to civil liberties in recent years, and this year was the most extreme example yet. A number of bills came down to lawmaker attempts to override Governor Laura Kelly's vetoes, with mixed results. Logan will share where the dust settled on those in this first conversation. For our second conversation, we welcome advocates from both Kansas and around the nation to share about the Second Look Act, a legislative initiative aimed at creating opportunities to reduce prison sentences, especially for those who were sentenced at a young age or those who have already served a prolonged sentence. From the Kansas Second Look Act Coalition, we have Shaquila Banks and Andre Williams. We also welcome back Sam Allison Natale, Executive Director of the Kansas Holistic Defenders, for an encore. From Illinois, we have Katrina Baugh, Senior Policy Director at Families Against Mandatory Minimums. And finally, we have Magdalena Chungus from the Maryland Second Look Act Coalition. Both of these conversations are led by our communications manager, Jesse Kielman. And so, without further ado, let's throw it to our first segment with Jesse and Logan.
I'm here with Logan DeMond, our policy director here at the ACLU of Kansas. Legislative session has wrapped up. We know where everything has kind of finalized. So we're going to dive in and talk about that. Can you just off the rip give us maybe a general idea of the tenor and posture of how things went this session?
I think I can best summarize the session with a single story that actually happened at the end of session. Morning agenda meetings had wrapped up. That's when legislators from both caucuses meet. They discuss what they'll be voting on that day, what they'll be debating, any strategy. So I was in the restroom washing my hands, and these two guys come in, two legislators from rural communities, and they're talking about everything that they have to do when they get home that weekend, things that they've had to neglect on their family farms because they'd been in Topeka. One was driving to Salina to sell some hogs. Another one was moving cattle that weekend. And they came up to the sink. I'm drying off my hands, and one looks at the other, and he said, "One thing's for dang sure. It's a good thing we don't run our farms like we run the Kansas legislature." And I think that story says a lot, right? It might elicit a chuckle, but when we think about it, shouldn't our civil rights, our civil liberties, the laws that govern our day-to-day lives, issues like the state budget, shouldn't those require more caution, more care than what we saw this session, with a fast pace, with things being rushed through the process, new maneuvers that we've never seen before being used on a day-to-day basis? It was a train wreck, and it was a train wreck by design.
So I think we a little bit knew that it was going to be a tough session going into it. Can you share a little bit more about how you kind of prepared, how you think about how you go into a session that you know is going to be a little bit of a slog in that way?
Yeah, you know, we try and be proactive in as many ways as we can. And I think it's important to note that for as tough as things were throughout the session, whether that's in the committee room or on the floor of the Kansas House or the Kansas Senate, and they're attempting veto overrides, the fact that they have supermajorities in both chambers and they can push through any legislation they want. But literally till the last second on the last day of session, we are fighting tooth and nail and actually able to stop some of the most egregious legislation from becoming law. That's a testament to the work we did with coalition members, we do with people power. I think when you go into a session, you know it's going to be tough. You never know what the one thing is that's going to change an outcome. So it's about the collective whole, right? The collective whole of the actions we take is what makes a change. We don't know if that's a meeting with an individual legislator, if it's a call to action form that we ask ACLU of Kansas supporters to fill out, if it's catching someone in the hallway, or if it's the testimony in the committee room. But we know if we do all those things, that's going to have an outsized impact on the bill at the end of the day. And I was happy to say that we stopped a few things because of those actions.
And on that then, could you give us kind of an overview of where the dust settled then ultimately? Because I know a lot went to veto session. I know we had some losses there, but we had a number of important saves as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So we sent a formal veto request letter to the governor asking her to veto 8 bills. 6 of those ultimately were sustained after earning a veto. But at the same time, we picked up some major wins in the end. I think attacks on voting rights at the end of the day were one of the largest themes this session. We were able to stop 2 out of 3 bundled bills at the end of session. Now, I can get into impacts of that just broadly. That could change the way we register to vote online using third-party sites that are often more accessible than the government websites that are available to voters or to people who want to register to vote. We're also talking about removing eligible voters from the voter rolls, identifying, flagging potential non-citizens, right? This myth of non-citizen voting or voter fraud happening at any large scale in the state of Kansas is just that. It's a myth, right? And so as a result, now we're reverting back to the errors of the cross-check lawsuit from just a few years ago and potentially identifying, flagging, and removing eligible voters from the rolls. And we ultimately were not able to stop that. That did become law. I think the other thing to point out was a massive immigration bill that they were able to push through the first day of veto session, unfortunately overriding the governor's veto. It changes the way our county sheriffs, our local law enforcement officers interact with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Instead of requiring a signed judicial warrant, these ICE detainers are now going to become more prevalent in Kansas. Indefinite detention is now on the table. Essentially, it removed a lot of the state protections we had against federal overreach. That's what's in this legislation. That's very concerning.
Yeah. So the bills that we stopped then, you said 2 bills that impact our voting rights were stopped. Can you kind of gesture towards what was stopped then versus, because the things you mentioned were what went through ultimately, right, with that third one?
Yeah. So I'll back up a little bit further before we get to the bundled bill.
Sure.
In its original form, there was a Senate bill that was introduced. It dealt with signature verification laws, which we know are discriminatory in practice, but it said that if a court issued a final order on a signature verification law, then mail-in voting across the board would be repealed. We put out a strong fight against that. We were able to actually get the language changed in the bill because of the pressure we had mounted on legislators. And instead, it would trigger the repeal of no excuse mail-in voting, which was actually last in effect in Kansas in 1995. This is the most regressive legislation in terms of voting rights you can imagine. We were able to actually stop that bill.
I think you really gestured towards this when you were talking about session, about you don't know what it is that's going to make the difference and the impact that people have on that. It's a similar posture, I think, now of, yes, the legislative session is important in lots of ways. And I think people understand that. But I think sometimes we allow that to overshadow how much local work, the fight is not over and the impacts, there was a bill that impacts how local law enforcement works with ICE agents. That's not the only thing that dictates that. Like, obviously we know that the 287G agreements that communities can voluntarily enter into. So people listening to this who don't want that ICE presence in their community can work with their local government on that. Likewise, we know that All Democracy is Local. We're working on an update to that publication, that report with new data. So likewise, those types of decisions are often made not in the legislature, but at the local level. It's hard when it's a tough session because it feels disempowering, and it's good to be reminded that we are empowered in so many other ways.
Yeah, I think it's easy to get lost in the despair of legislative session. But it's important to remember that there are still several levers we can pull, and we are continuing to do that here at the ACLU of Kansas. You mentioned the local level. I think that is one lever we can still pull and make significant change, right? And I'm not just talking with elected officials. I'm talking about calls to action, right? Contacting your local elected officials, showing up in local elections. The more that we contact our elected officials, we make our concerns known, the more pressure we put on them, the more likely we are to see change, right? We know the federal government's a mess. We know that even state government is incredibly messy. That's the first 3 months of the year. What are we going to do with the other 9? We know that we can use our power at the local level. We know that we can use our power with litigation. There are several levers still left to pull. There is still hope. There is always hope, and we can't give that up.
Yeah, it's an eternal fight. When you win, the fight goes on, and when you have setbacks, the fight goes on. So that's a really great reminder for that. Well, thank you so much for your time and for that update, Logan.
Yeah, thank you, Jesse.
to get started, I just was hoping that everyone could do a quick introduction of more about themselves, share why and how they got involved with the Second Look At Coalition, and anything else that they want to share. And so, DeAndre, you're on my screen, so I'm going to let you start.
My name is DeAndre. I got first involved with the coalition about mid-2023. Actually, it's been about that long. I heard about it through Andre Lee. He's actually incarcerated right now. He's served 30 years, and he's seized a board in probably about another 10 years. So this is something that really directly applies to him. And he's somebody that I can just really vouch for as far as character goes and just, you know, really deserving of an opportunity. I started by proxy and just really seeing this theme that it created and how many people it really mattered to. And since then, it just really took wings of its own. I was born and raised in Kansas, Wichita, went to Southeast High. And I think that this just really, it means a lot to me just because we don't really have something like this in Kansas right now to afford people the opportunity to have taken that road towards redemption, that have done the programs and the classes and have really just had that type of exemplary behavior that, you know, the rehabilitation is supposed to produce. They haven't really had that opportunity or an outlet for that. So I feel like the Second Look Act is something that can really break away for us.
Katrina, you're next on my chart, so I'm going to jump to you next.
Hi, I am Katrina. I'm the Senior Policy Director at FAM. We're a national level organization that does criminal justice reform in all 50 states. And I personally have done a lot of work in Illinois. Illinois is one of the states that has already embraced Second Look, and I've learned quite a bit from how that has been implemented here. And I am eager to make sure that Kansas does not replicate the mistakes of Illinois. So that is a part of the reason that I'm here, in addition to the fact that I just genuinely believe every person deserves consideration.
That's awesome. I also don't want Kansas to repeat the mistakes of Illinois, so I appreciate that. I'm excited to hear more about what those pitfalls might be. Shaquila, can I jump to you next?
Absolutely. I'm Shaquila Banks, born and raised in Wichita, Kansas. I first got involved with the coalition a couple years ago. Someone in Hutchinson Correctional Facility had told me about a petition that was going around. So I had got on change.org to look it up, and I found who the person was, which was DeAndre. And I'm like, okay, I went to high school with him. I'm going to just reach out to him. And I was asking him like, hey, what's going on around this? Like, is there anything that I can do to, you know, help out, to push it? And we really didn't have much information. So we spoke to a few lawmakers and they gave us some tips. And so one of them was building a coalition. So that pumped us to do that. So I work for the Department of Corrections. I've seen lengthy sentences handed out to young kids at the age of 15. So it's like, wow, I believe in transformation. So I'm really passionate about that. And when you look at the laws that we currently have in Kansas, some of those kids won't even be considered until they're about 60. So, yeah, that's where my passion comes from.
Wow. Thank you. Thanks for helping arrange this, too. You've helped so much in getting all of us in the same conversation, and that's really, really rad. So thank you. Magdalena?
I'm Magdalena Chungus, and I started the Maryland Second Look Coalition, which I started because my partner has been serving a life without parole sentence since he was 19. And in Maryland, we had a juvenile version of Second Look that passed, and I started organizing around expanding that to make an avenue for him. And I got connected to DeAndre through one of our coalition members, similar to what Katrina shared, happy to share, you know, our successes and areas of growth from our experiences in Maryland.
Thank you so much. And Sam, we're going to end with a familiar face here.
My name is Sam Allison Natale. I'm the executive director of Kansas Holistic Defenders. We're a nonprofit law firm serving poor and working class people here facing criminal charges or evictions in Kansas. I got involved in this project. It feels like a chain that runs from DeAndre to Shaquila to me, where, you know, my partner is a teacher and active in the labor movement, and another teacher who we had been in relationship with for some years finally said, hey, I don't tell a lot of people this, but my son is serving a 30 plus year sentence for something that he did when he was about 22 years old. And you know, what can we do? What can we do for him? And there was nothing that I, as an attorney, could do. There are problems that an individual attorney cannot solve. But as an organizer, I understood that it was possible for enough of us to come together around something that would potentially free her son and thousands of other people like him. So we formed something called the Kansas Prisoner Organizing Project, KPOP, and started looking into what would help him and people like him, what would help our people and our people's people, and found this incredible bill that had been proposed. And I start saying, how do we have this? Who is introducing this? How did this get here? Because, you know, we're looking around and not seeing the kind of movement infrastructure for incarcerated people or formerly incarcerated people or people with loved ones on the inside. And I said, who did this? And I found out Shaquila did this and found the Second Look Act Coalition and decided that we were going to throw our organization into this fight because it is the only hope, truly, that thousands of people in our state prisons have for a second chance and a reevaluation of their extremely long sentences, which are too common.
Thank you for sharing that. That's a perfect segue because the Second Look Act might be kind of an, I don't know if I want to say a new initiative, but it's an ongoing initiative to get implemented here in Kansas, but it has already been implemented in different places and in different variations. And so, Katrina, I was going to start with you. Could you help maybe describe some of the ways that this idea and this initiative has been tweaked for different situations and the effect that we've seen from that?
Yeah, so I'm definitely most familiar with how it's been working in Illinois. And I can say we really pushed this initially because it was the manner of second chance that was most politically palatable. When we talk about giving people consideration for early release, so many people, that's just like alarms go off in their head. And we know those people don't typically have loved ones inside or know anyone who is incarcerated, but that's the political reality we're operating in. So when we were pushing a number of different second look mechanisms, it was the prosecutor-initiated resentencing that was really accepted by our elected officials. So we were able to move this forward, and essentially anyone in Illinois, if you can get the prosecutor who charged you to say, hey, this person deserves to be looked at again, they should be resentenced, and bring you back to the original sentencing court and make the argument on your behalf, then the judge has the freedom to shorten your sentence in any way they deem to be correct. And so this hit all of the right political notes. It ensures that you're going back to the place where, you know, the contract was made. And so this is where you can renegotiate the contract. And all the people who we are most concerned about in this kind of decision are like back in the decision-making pool for this. So it made it through. And after it passed, it really hasn't done anything. It's been rather devastating. It brought a lot of hope when it came through, but I'm aware of three people who have successfully had their case taken by their original prosecutor and brought back to the judge, and the judge denied it in all three cases. And so I think the real problem was that it is prosecutors who it was dependent on. And very rarely are prosecutors convinced that someone, you know, they very rarely want to undo the good work they think they did. And so it's very rare that this gets considered at all. Yeah, I'm really grateful to see that it is not prosecutor initiated in this proposal. I think that gives it so much more hope, and that when it is driven by the people who have the hope for release, that it is a lot more powerful.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. And a great segue, because in this proposal, which was headed up by DeAndre initially, it sounds like you started the petition to bring the Second Look Act to Kansas. Can you share a little bit more about that process and why you were motivated to do that?
I told you how it was originally brought to me back in 2023, but I served time myself. You know, I was incarcerated. I got a sentence at a young age, and I was sentenced to 10 years. And with sentencing structures and how it could have been, I could have got a lot more time. During my time, I mean, I took nearly every program, class you could take. We did plays, concerts. I helped in the infirmary and took classes on how to be a better dad. I don't even have kids, you know, and none of these were exactly to give me any program credits. I didn't qualify for any of them, but it was really kind of to show that, you know, I know a lot of people that are like me, that were young when they were incarcerated, and they're just completely different people. They're just completely different people. And unfortunately, you know, they just have to exemplify that to their families, you know, to their peers. They haven't really gotten the opportunity to show it to society, to show that they can run a successful business, to show that they can really enter the workforce and really be successful. When I seen the criteria or the eligibility, you know, for this, I just felt like it really resonated, just because I felt like those were the ones who really needed the opportunity. So much science has showed just the mental changes, you know, and changes that they go through under the age of 25, the way that they develop, you know. When I first got approached by Shaquila, you know, of course, she was like a godsend because she was just as hype about it at the time. She was just, yeah, like, you know, what can we do? How can we get it started? And I started the petition. It was really just on change.org. I came back after, you know, days, or I'll come back after some weeks or so, and just checking the numbers and seeing people that signed. And I had noticed one time I came back and I didn't know that people could leave testimonials, and they had left comments and they had left videos. And it was just like a whole different spark that it had gave me. I just seen like, man, it just touched people all across Kansas, and people that weren't even from Kansas, but just had loved ones that this, you know, this affected. It just gave even more. It just gave even more spark to it.
I really appreciate that. The perspective that comes with that and the power of that change is really meaningful. So thank you for sharing that. And another great transition for Sam. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about how and why you started advocating for the Second Look Act, the unique challenges, the importance of the Second Look Act, and maybe a little bit about what Katrina has shared of how it might look a little bit different here in Kansas.
Yeah, I think one major reason to support the Second Look Act is because of the need, not just for this piece of legislation, but for a mass movement in Kansas of people who are against mass incarceration. And, you know, we have to, as simple as this is, get people out of prison and make prisons less bad. And this generation of a movement is going to rely upon organic leaders who are already in touch with the folks who are being most affected and already hearing those stories and already knowing what people want and need. And here we have, I think, some clear leadership. The petition that DeAndre started, the traction that Shaquila's gotten through the Second Look Act Coalition, says to me that this is a demand that resonates with thousands of working class Kansans. And the reason why, I think, has to do with the common sense of people. We see, as a public defender, I see all the time that people can change. I see people that the judges or prosecutors are ready to throw away, especially when they're young, especially when their brain is still developing, become totally different through the course of time. And I think people can see that in their own lives and their own relationships, and ask the question of, why is my loved one still here? Or what if I had gotten this horrible sentence at a time that I was just a different person? People can see themselves in this policy and in this demand, and it resonates with the base sense of fairness that I think that Kansans truly feel. Most Kansans truly are not evil, are not cruel, do want the possibility of redemption and transformation. And so just seeing that this was where the people are in this moment, in thinking how we can move past our current over-reliance on prisons. There's obviously the tremendous effects that this kind of legislation has. On the other hand, as Kansas uses a sentencing grid that operates on a somewhat inflexible and mathematical logic based on someone's criminal history category and the category of their offense. And it is encoded with these extremely outdated ideas about what is important, what do we care about. A possession of marijuana with a sufficient criminal history can, in Kansas, still to this day send you away easily for 20, 30 years. And there are indeed still Kansans serving long, long sentences on marijuana, on drug possession. But even and especially people who have often committed acts of violence are maybe no more likely than anyone else to commit another one when the circumstances of their lives, when the development of their brains, when the development of their insight has changed. And so I think that this policy could be transformative depending on, you know, as our friend from FAM reminded us about those details of how it happens. You know, the upside of Kansas's sentencing system is that there is already within the law, without a change of any kind, a possibility for something called a departure, right? A judge can make specific findings of fact that are compelling enough to justify a movement away from what this cold, impersonal grid says should be the sentence and into something else. And oftentimes, at the point that that decision is being made, the judges don't have all the information that they would have 10 years later about what this person would end up being in prison, what this person would end up doing in prison, what the transformation. I believe that these things matter to judges. I see judges, and not just liberal judges, judges of all political stripes, caring deeply about making the right decision, caring deeply about the individual humanity of people before them. And sometimes all of that information is not there at one point, and new information can be brought before them. And I do see a world in which judges make a different decision for many, many people.
Thank you for sharing that, Sam. I want to open it up to kind of the group on this one. What are some of the common misconceptions about the Second Look Act? And I think that's either specifics, or I know there's just so much harmful rhetoric around the criminal legal process in general that you might find is applicable or disproportionately aimed towards this initiative. And what corrections can you provide for those misunderstandings?
This is not early release. This is not soft on crime. This is not do 10 years and you get out. This is educated review. This is bringing experts to our panel. And, you know, at the end of the day, those who are serving exorbitant sentences without any reason, you know, is really a blackout of public safety.
And I just wanted to add that another misconception is that this policy or a second look policy would ignore victims, and that is definitely not the case. Some policies include victim notification or like their input. Some victims actually do support the release when they do see that someone has genuinely changed and, you know, taken accountability, and others may not. However, their voice is still a part of that process. So victims are not ignored. It doesn't erase the harm, but it just helps us expand how we think about healing.
If I can just add one last thing, I would say the biggest misconception I often run into is that this will somehow decrease public safety, when in reality, this is the strongest way to increase public safety. When you just introduce the reality of a potential review for someone who is serving prison time, the amount that incentivizes good behavior and engagement in programming and education is immense. It's the biggest possible carrot you can offer someone. Everyone wants to go home. Mm-hmm. But then when you are now reviewing and potentially returning to the community, people who have really invested in personal transformation and in doing that work, then that is how we promote public safety, by putting people back in the communities who have done that work. And so this is actually a public safety measure. In no way would it harm public safety.
With that, I find too, of like the rhetoric that people want to throw around of like of public safety, there's no end point to that. I continually realize you can be additionally punitive and additionally punitive and hurtful and harsh, and there's no like, oh, and then we're done. It's like you can always come up with more. And so it takes heart and mind to counteract that and look at the reality and the real people behind that. I think that was a really great reminder of that. Magdalena, I have a question for you next. Can you share a little bit more about the process and the results of implementing the Second Look Act in Maryland, and maybe any insight that you have of how that might apply to Kansas as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I shared in my introduction, in Maryland in 2021, we passed the Juvenile Restoration Act, which was second look for children who were charged as adults. And so what that bill did is give those people a second look after 20 years of incarceration. And it also banned the use of juvenile life without parole going forward. So really building upon the success of that passage and the success of people who have came home off of the JRA, we worked to pass the Second Look Act in Maryland. While we started with hopes to have a bill that applied to everyone, what ultimately passed was for an emerging adult population and only those who are already parole eligible to have a second look. And so we know there's still more work to be done. But I think, you know, as we're implementing the bill, it passed about a year ago, went into effect in October. And so people are starting to have hearings. No one has come home yet off the bill. But I think we're really similar to the juvenile version of the bill. You know, there are people who have done 30, 40, even 50 years in prison and had not had the opportunity to show their rehabilitation. And having this avenue, right, really gives them that opportunity to demonstrate their rehabilitation and possibly come home and serve their communities one day. And really, our coalition, I think, is an example of what happens when people do get that opportunity, because people who have loved ones inside and people who have come home. And so we have coalition members who have done 40 plus years and came home off of the Juvenile Restoration Act and are now working in reentry, working in parole, working as the violence interrupters in the community, and then supporting work like passing the second look for the people who they love, who they left inside. To me, that really demonstrates why it's worth investing in second chances, because of the work that people do when they come back home. For Kansas, like a lot of you have said already, like really recognizing that it's not a get out of jail free card for anybody, because a judge can say no to everyone who comes in front of them, right? There's no guarantee anyone will be released, but it is an opportunity to say, if we believe in rehabilitation and that people can change, that someone should be looking at their rehabilitation and determining if they can serve the community as a free person.
It's very helpful. Thank you for sharing that. Shaquila, I'm going to bounce over to you next. Can you tell us more about what we've learned about community safety and healing in states that have implemented the Second Look Act policy?
Yeah, absolutely. So to add to what Katrina had said, the Second Look policy does not put the public at risk. I've learned that people do age out of crime. There's been a lot of research that shows that as people get older, they don't reoffend, you know, and since Second Look policies are geared towards people who are serving longer sentences, then those people that are eligible will be far away from, you know, that risky age. I've also learned that healing is broader than just punishment. Healing is not a one-size-fits-all. and punishment alone doesn't meet every family's need when it comes to that healing process. The second look at it restores families, it restores communities, especially if the reentry part is where it needs to be when those people return back into our community.
Yeah, I really appreciate you focusing on the restoration and the healing that comes with this too, because that is so important. I think that's a guiding light that really guide a lot of our efforts writ large, and this one obviously in particular. Katrina, I'm going to ask you now, could you share a little bit more about the economic impact and the other considerations that some people may not necessarily think about if this bill were to be passed here in Kansas?
Definitely. I think prisons should be seen for what they are economically, which is money pits. We just burn money with every dollar we spend to punish a person by keeping them incarcerated. This is our society's commitment to really spending money to make sure people are adequately punished. This is the end in itself. There is no good that comes from it. If there is rehabilitation that happens to come out from it, that credit goes to that individual. If there's a program that's available that helps that person, that's not inherent to the prison. That is separate from it. When we are spending dollars to keep people behind bars, that money dies there, right? I really think if most people understood that we spend about $30,000 a year to incarcerate a person in Kansas, and we also should expect a Kansan to spend about $30,000 a year if they were to go to Kansas State University, and that would cover tuition, room, board, fees, books, all the stuff that you have to pay for school. I think people would understand that. Of course, we would rather spend that money investing in our future. You can either use $30,000 to harm someone, or you can use $30,000 to invest in Kansas's future. And I think most politicians, most human beings would say yes, this every time. And I also think victims would feel that way. I know victims often feel that way, that if you said, hey, I know this person caused you harm, we're planning to give them a 15-year sentence. But if you agree, we will just give them an 11-year sentence, and then we'll spend the other 4 years of money on your child. So they're going to go to college for free. I don't know a single victim that would say no to that. They are pro-investing in the future above harming people for what's happened in the past. So for what it's worth, the economics of prisons never make sense. It's about sitting in the past rather than investing in the future.
Incredibly well put. Thank you so much. Well, we are close to wrapping up now. I want to thank you all for joining this conversation and for everything you've shared. It's been really meaningful and really helpful. And so thank you all. To end, I'm going to give everyone a chance. If you wanted to share an example of a story of why this bill mattered and should be passed, or if you had another message of hope or just thought in general that you want to leave listeners with to close out, I welcome that from anyone who wants to jump in.
I can start. Who I was at the age of 15, who I was in my 20s, and who I am in my 30s are three different versions of me. And I feel like everybody can agree. And I feel like if we all understand that and we all can shake our head and say, yeah, you're absolutely right, then I feel like our policies should reflect that change as well, that transformation, the human transformation. So yeah, I think we should consider that. You can follow us on social media. We have Facebook and Instagram, Kansas Second Look. That's what you'll look up. Also, you can join our coalition. You can email us if you have any questions. We meet every first Thursday of the month. And our email address is kslac255@gmail.com. Thank you, everyone, for joining.
I'll say that as it pertains to public safety, there is no better incentive than hope. So for those that we have incarcerated, if there's a fear from, you know, the public of the risk of them coming home, I ask them to, you know, rest assured that it was well deserved, it was well earned. And if they petitioned to review and that if they were awarded, you know, that release, that they've taken a lot of steps to get there, that they've made a lot of changes to be there, you know, and that everyone deserves to be considered, you know, and everyone deserves a chance to be reviewed again in life, whether you are incarcerated or not. You deserve a chance to be seen for who you are, from what you developed into, you know, and I think that we have an opportunity to do that here with this bill.
For me, it's about the people who I've seen who have been able to come home off of the Juvenile Restoration Act. I have a coalition member who was 15 years old when he was given a life sentence and served 42 years in prison. And in his 2.5 years of being home, he's married his wife. He's had a son. He works in reentry supporting other people who are coming home. And I think his life and the life of so many other people who have had this opportunity is redemption in action and shows us like what people really can do and are hoping to do with their lives to be redeemed for the worst thing that they've ever done. And so that's what really is at the core, I think, of Second Look, is recognizing the ability for people to be redeemed.
And I'll jump in because I'm going to say the same thing as Magdalena. I failed to mention at the beginning that I do consider myself an honorary Kansan. My best friend is from Winfield, Kansas. Yeah, not too far from Wichita. And also, I'm a Mennonite, and we might be a wild like subculture in Kansas, but from outside of Kansas's perspective, Kansas is the Mennonite homeland. So it's the land of my people. And my faith is also really what drives me in this work. And I think a lot of people in Kansas are also people of faith. And so I really think that people ought to reflect on that when they are thinking about whether or not someone deserves consideration, even if it's just an adherence to the golden rule. If you were in that position, would you want someone to take a look at you? And I think we ought to extend that same kind of consideration to others.
I want to build on something that Katrina had said, which was the economic impact. Every Kansan unnecessarily incarcerated is a theft from our communities. It is a theft of a person from our communities, and is a theft from our community resources because we are the taxpayers. And every time that they put someone in prison instead of putting down another public school or fully funding special education or giving what our communities deserve, the state is stealing our people and our resources from our community. And the solution to this is you. When I mean you, I mean, yes, you listening. The engine of history is regular people showing up. It is DeAndre starting a petition. It's Shaquila forming the Second Look Act Coalition. It is people who show up. The world isn't just run by the powerful. It is run by the people who show up. And I would encourage anybody listening to this, if you have a loved one, if you care about this, if your faith compels you to open up a path of redemption for people who are incarcerated, to please get involved in the Second Look Act Coalition. This is going to take us a long time. It's going to take us a long time, and it's a lot of people that we're going to need. You know, my mom was a public defender, and she used to tell me that injustice is like a big tree, and we've got this tiny axe, and we got to just keep on chipping away at it. And we are going to do this for this bill, because no matter how long it takes us to win a Second Look Act in Kansas, if that's another year, if that's 3 years, if that's 5 years, if that's 10, 15, 30 years, that's how long our people who are unnecessarily incarcerated would have to wait anyway. So we're in it for the long haul. And the best time to get involved is right now.
Well, to finish our conversation, I just want to say thank you one more time to all of you, both for joining us today, but for all the work you're doing to make the world a better, more restorative place. So thank you.
Thank you to Shaquila, Dondre, Magdalena, Katrina, and Sam for sharing their insights on the Second Look Act and for their work to improve our broken criminal legal system. Our thanks also go out to Logan for the update about his work under the dome in Topeka. Let us all now enjoy 8 months of rest until the next legislative session starts in January, because chances are we're going to need all the rest and energy we can get. But before we look ahead all the way to January of 2027, there's something very important that happens first. I'm talking about the midterm election happening later this year. If you're unhappy with the way that this legislative session went, and we certainly are, elections are your chance to hold decision makers accountable. And while participating as a voter is incredibly important, I'd like to extend an invitation to you to have an even greater impact by joining our election protection team at the ACLU of Kansas. If you haven't heard about our election protection program, here's the gist. It's a nonpartisan collaboration with the 1-866-OUR-VOTE telephone hotline to help ensure that voters have their votes counted. If there's an issue, voters can work with our team to help get it resolved. Not only is this important to resolving issues on Election Day and the days before, it's also vital in helping us understand what issues arise in elections, which guides our long-term efforts to educate, advocate, and make elections more accessible for every eligible person going forward. As a volunteer, you'll help observe polling locations and be a key resource to connect anyone facing issues to our trained team of attorneys. To learn more and join the election protection team, go to aclukansas.org/EP. Again, that's aclukansas.org/EP. That does it for this month's episode of Marching On. Tune in next month for more conversations with the people who are at the heart of the civil liberties movement here in Kansas. Until next time, keep marching on.